We thank you for your goodness toward us. We ask that you would guide us into all truth, cause us to be a people who pursue you. I pray especially that you would give us this day a real grasp of your grace, your hope, your purpose, your dignity and destiny for us, so that we would be a people of purpose and destiny. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. As you know, the Romans chapters 12 through 16 build upon the foundation, which is found in chapters 1 through 11, especially 1 to 8, and more specifically there, in the resources we've been given, particularly in view of our identification with Christ. This is radical truth that's quite unique. The idea in Romans 6 about our identification with Christ and his death, burial, and resurrection is a deep and profound mystery that we cannot fully grasp, but it has huge implications for the spiritual life because it tells us that Christ's life and resources are now our own. Not that we become absorbed into him, but that he has given us his life, which is in the very center of our being. And consequently, it's an inside-out journey, a process of growth and transformation, so that we become a people who begin to manifest a quality that cannot be accounted for in the basis of nature and nurture. You cannot account for the true, the spiritual person, the person who's walking with Jesus, on the basis of environment and heredity. That there is yet a new dimension to us that is not to be found in those more elementary principles of the world, namely the dimension of the indwelling power of the Spirit of Christ in us. And that being found in, especially in Romans chapter 8, the whole idea in Romans 6 is our new identity. Romans 8 is our empowering by the Spirit of God, gives us the picture that Christianity is not so much a do and a don't thing, although many people reduce it just to a bunch of do's and don'ts, rules and regulations, but it's not that. It's about a relationship. It's not about a religion. It is about an intimacy with a person rather than just the things that we do. And that the idea is that, as I've stressed many times, who we are in this vision ought to shape what we do. The world tells you that what you do determines who you are. The problem with that, though, is when you don't perform well, or you know, you just always find that the world is asking for, what have you done for me lately? And so the issue really is going to be that in the biblical perspective, who we are in Jesus ought to then become what we do. That should eventually become more and more evident, though never perfectly in this world, because we are not yet complete. We're still in the process. We're still imperfect in terms of our behaviors, our attitudes, and so forth. But even so, before God, in our deepest selves, we've been made new. And that is the issue. So it's not a matter of achieving merit, attaining perfection in our own power, or trying to impress or achieve before God, but rather that God himself says, you couldn't possibly do it, and only when you admit that you cannot do it, then I will give you my life, and once you've received that, you become acceptable before me. And ultimately, I will complete the process that I've begun in the spiritual level, and so that on your soulish level, your mind, your wills, and your emotions, and even ultimately your body, these all will be transformed. I went to Joyce Shortell's funeral at the Cathedral of St. Philip on Friday. Any of you get to go to that? Yeah, a few of you did. And, you know, for me, it's not so much of it was a funeral as it was a kind of a celebration for her really now moving in something that's far, far better off. She's far better off. And Bruce knows this in a very real way, though he misses her, and of course we do. There is this idea of not grieving as those who have no hope. We realize that ultimately that this life is only a transition and preparation for our eternal citizenship in heaven. And ultimately, even our bodies will be resurrected so that we walk in hope. And I have to tell you, it was an intriguing experience again to be there. Hadn't been to the cathedral in quite a long time. The actual people that I saw that I'd known from years ago, now off in various places, apostles, St. Jude's here at Christ Church, some still at the cathedral. and a variety of other places, some who had left town. Also seeing some of the people I knew before, David Chamberlain and other ministers. It was a very interesting experience because it gave me a sort of a longing for the true communion of saints. The true longing for what will it be when all those things are taken care of, and then the true unity that we will enjoy where there never need to be any more goodbyes. It's a nice concept. But my point is this, that the biblical thrust is always going to be that what you do, being, ultimately determines doing, and that's what we're about here. Because of what we are, now we can talk about the application. And particularly in Romans chapter 12, verses 3 through 21, we're looking here about our relationship with other people. We looked already a couple weeks ago at verses 1 through 8, and there we were looking at the whole concept of spiritual gifts and all of us having a particular role and a function to play. The important thing that we have to keep in mind is that God has actually equipped us and called us to accomplish something that, if we allow Him, will reverberate forever. The greatest accomplishment you will make on this planet, apart from Him, whether you build a business that's successful, whether you raise children, no matter what you accomplish, all these things will quickly fade away. All those things will perish. In fact, it says the day is coming when the earth and its works will be burned up. And therefore, it would be very unwise, would it not, for us to give our hearts in exchange for something that God has promised will perish. And yet I think a lot of people are giving their hope, their hearts in exchange for a bucket of mammon. And God says He's burning it up. Instead, He says, go for that which will endure. And my view, as many of you know, is that there's no need for there to be a sacred-secular distinction. Even your business can be something that is honoring to God when you do it for His sake. Remember that line that I may have used? I never know what I say in which group because I repeat myself a lot. But that way you learn it anyway. This is partly deliberate and partly because I don't remember what I've said. But when I did the Chariots of Fire and went through that in November 6th, there were a lot of scenes I'd forgotten. Even now I'm preparing for my next movie, Gladiator. Some people say, why Gladiator? Because it's a great film in terms of action. It's got, it may be a guy flick, but actually there are a lot of spiritual lessons in it. Besides which, I'm starting with really popular films to create a taste for this so that I can get into the things that really are interesting. But having said that, in Chariots of Fire, there's this wonderful scene where Eric Little is in a little room, and he's talking with the head of the missionary society there, and ultimately Eric's plan is to go to China and be a missionary, which he in fact did fulfill, and it was in occupied China in fact in 1945 that he lost his life when the Japanese invaded. But he also knew that he was fast, and he also knew that he was called, given that skill, for a reason. And significantly, the missionary society had really asking, how fast are you? And then his friend Sandy kind of says what he has the possibility even of Olympic gold in the 1924 Paris Olympics. At this point, the fellow doesn't say, don't do that, you ought to go to China. But he says, actually, Eric, you can peel a man can peel a spud to the glory of God if he does it with excellence. Isn't that an interesting idea? There's not a thing you can't do that's not to the glory of God if you do it for His sake and if you do it with excellence. He said, run in God's name and let the world watch in wonder. And so the idea here is that you and I have been given unique abilities and gifts. And it's my conviction that as we discover what those are and do them in His name, you will feel His pleasure and the world will, I think, be affected. And I believe that those things, that spiritual fruit, will remain. So if there is something we can accomplish in this planet that will endure, it's what we do in the name of Jesus. And my view is there's nothing that we cannot do. There are no component of our lives that cannot be invaded by this. Certainly this is true in our verses ahead. If we look at verses 9 to 21, what we see here are factors that relate to our relationship with other people. There's this new commandment that we see when he talks about love. Let love, verse 9, be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. Let me just stop there a minute and remind you of that image that's in the Upper Room Discourse. When Jesus was with his disciples, he knew for the last time before his crucifixion, and he left these important words to them. And one of the things he shared in the upper room there, knowing that his hour had come, that he should depart from the world, which means he has the opportunity, he knows, this is his last opportunity to build into those lives before he departs. I promise you, if you had an opportunity to be with your friends, knowing that you'd be really with the Lord less than 24 hours later, you wouldn't be talking about trivial matters, would you? You'd be sharing things that really are significant, things that really matter. And certainly Jesus, knowing that his hour had come, what we hear here in these chapters, basically John chapter 13 to 17, are the absolute essence of the themes that would then later be developed in the epistles. We have the essence of the spiritual life. One of the radical things he says to them in these words, this is in John 13:34, a new commandment I give to you. This is a radical concept that he himself, with the authority of the living God, gives them this new commandment. This new commandment is that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. How is that a new commandment? What was the old commandment? Remember the two great commandments that Jesus uses to summarize the entire law and the prophets? The first one was that you shall love the Lord your God with all your mind, heart, soul, and strength. And the second is like unto it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments, the entire law and the prophets hang. Now, how is this new commandment different from loving your neighbor as yourself? The answer is, it's a much higher commandment. Because now how are we to love them? Yes. So you are to love one another even as I have loved you. May I tell you that he loves you more than you love yourself? Now that might seem odd to us and counterintuitive, but part of the way we know this is that one of the measures of love is what a person desires for another. I define the agape of God, that kind of love, that special love, which is a love of choice, as the steady intention of your will toward another person's highest good. So that it's not a feeling love or an emotional love, but it's a choosing love. Remember that contrast between the rock of feelings, rock of choice versus the sand of feelings. The sand of feelings won't sustain relationships, but the rock of choice will, even when feelings come and go. My point here, this is a love of choice. And so I define that as the steady intention of your will toward another's highest good. Now, to be perfectly frank with you, only God knows what our highest good is, and he is utterly committed to it. If we were given the choice, there are times when we would choose what's not our highest good, but what's inferior, because we really don't know what our highest good is, A, and B, it just seems that it might be the path at first blush. It looks like the path of sacrifice rather than gain. But God well knows what our truest good is, and he well knows that the purpose of this world is not that we be happy and comfortable here so much as that we become holy and men and women of character here, and that we are prepared for eternity. And in understanding that then, he would choose better for us than we would choose for ourselves. In fact, I believe that if we're not careful, we would slip into mediocrity. What we might be tempted to do is to compare ourselves with other people in our lives or in our industries, and then say, hey, I'm doing better than most. And that might be actually to commit yourself to too little. And then God would say, I didn't call you to mediocrity. I called you to greatness. And I've defined you in such a way that I can make you great in an area if you'll just give me your life. And so in looking at these commandments and looking at this text, what we see here is a greatness to which we are called. In his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Edward Gibbons isolated five factors that he used to explain the influence and indeed the rapid spread of Christianity. And the fifth of those factors in the first century was the unity and mutual love that was quite evident among these early followers of Jesus. Caecilius in the first century wrote this of the Christian church. He said, they know each other by secret marks and signs, and they love each other heartily before they know one another. Isn't that an interesting idea? If you, you know, it's possible to love somebody even before you like them. In fact, there's some people we're called to love even if we don't like. Because love, remember, is a choice of the will. Like is a feeling word. He doesn't say, a new commandment I give to you that you like one another. Because that's an impossible command. He cannot command you to like somebody. What if there are just some people that aren't that likable or that you don't have any chemistry with? But he does command us to love others. That doesn't mean that you have to like them. You see the difference there? You can choose another's good even if you don't really are not attracted to them. And that is the choice. And that's what was evident. The enemies of Christianity have noted this inadvertently. There are those who actually have hated, like I'm thinking about the commissioner of education in the former Soviet Union, who said that that he hated Christians. In fact, he regarded them as enemies because they preach love to one's neighbor and pity, which is contrary to our principles, which is an interesting admission. You see, the problem of substituting the appearance of love for the real thing, however, becomes very evident. And I see a sort of plasticine love that often takes place when we can go into so-called spiritual context or fellowship. And what we see there is often just a superficial rather than the real thing. Who is talking on that thing? What's that? Oh, it's a beeper. Oh. There are false expressions, I think, of warmth and love that take place during, for example, during the Christmas season. Is there any way of? That, don't you love it? Yeah. Yeah, just trying to be helpful here. So here we're in the bowels of the earth, and now we're getting all these conversations as well. But in any case, there are false expressions of warmth and love. Think about the Christmas season. There's a kind of a superficial appearance of the real thing, but not the real thing at all. We can, if we're not careful, be tempted to simulate and feign the real thing. And we have to have this understanding in Romans 12:9. Let love be without hypocrisy. Hypokrites comes from the Greek word for masks that were used in Greek drama. You've all seen them in playbills. And in theaters, you'll see the one with the smile and the other one with the sad frown or whatever. You see them. You see those. You've all seen those. Those are the masks that Greek actors would use, and they'd actually put them on, and that was the image that they would have. And so the putting on the mask then was the idea of a person used of an actor who plays a part. And Paul wants love to be genuine and sincere rather than hypocritical. Not to be hypocritical is to give the pretense, but without having the reality. And so this exhortation is certainly used in the context of these spiritual gifts in Romans chapter 12. It's also to be used also in 1 Corinthians 12, 13, and 14, where Paul sandwiches that great chapter on love that's so often used at wedding ceremonies. But that actual context is about spiritual gifts both before and after. And so he's saying there that whatever we do to edify one another needs to be done in the context of genuine love without hypocrisy. And so what we see here in verses 9 and following is that love is the basis for all that Paul will say in the remainder of this chapter. These verses are like a garden. And in this garden, it's filled with very fair and fragrant flowers, and our lives would be beautiful if these flowers were in our hearts. We would be, I think, different husbands. We'd be different wives, neighbors, employees, employers. They're like the blooming of Christ's love in our hearts when we read these verses. And we'll take a stroll, I think, through this little garden. And what we'll do is look at a few of the details. I took about 450 pictures with my new digital camera when I went to England. And then I got rid of the ones that aren't really good. But really, quite a lot of them turned out quite well. So it's my screensaver now. Every few seconds another image comes up and I'll see Barnsley Garden or Hever Castle or Scotney Castle and all these wonderful places in England that we visited. And the beauty of those flowers and so forth is just always a reminder of the glory of God in the created order. So as we look at these blossoms, we're going to see also that there are going to be some of these things that may be specific to us, and ask the Spirit of God to use this text, this section, as a diagnostic tool to see that aspect of true love that may be more deficient than another. In verses 9 to 16, what we see is our relationship with fellow believers. Let me read those. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor. Not like lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, persevering in tribulation, devoted to prayer, contributing to the needs of the saints, practicing hospitality. Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice, and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not be haughty in mind, but associate with the lowly. Do not be wise in your own estimation. I'll stop there because verses 17 to 21 focus more on our relationship with people who may be outsiders. But I want to look at one cluster. There are three clusters I want us to see right here. The first cluster is in the last half of verse 9. Where he says, abhor what is evil and cling to what is good. Genuine love won't tolerate really evil and corrupt talking and condone evil conduct. And there are times, for example, when I have done or something or said something that really wasn't appropriate. And I've had people who loved me enough to take me aside privately and to rebuke me. Ever have somebody do that? Rare is the person who's blessed with a friend who will love you enough to do that. But there have been times when I said something or whatever that may have been inappropriate, and I may not even have been aware of it, and somebody cared for me enough. And what's really going on here is learning to discern and abhor evil because it's sin. And the one who truly loves will hate what's evil in the lives of the people they love. And so we will speak the truth in love to another person when needful, and we will communicate that to them. And really exercise loving accountability. At the point at which we enjoy doing this, better not do it. This is not something one enjoys doing. It's something one chooses to do, though, if we see that a friend has a blind spot in their lives. The second cluster is found in verses 10 to 13, and this is the largest of the three. This relates to general attitudes of believers in present society. Here are 10 attitudes I want us to look at. Number one, be devoted to one another in brotherly love, in verse 10. The person with genuine love is devoted to other believers. Devoted is used in the ties of kindred, the closest relationships. So the idea here is to love those who are brothers and sisters in the faith as though they were, in fact, our relatives or our family. And so there is this idea of loving people in that level. And that's why I think we need small fellowships. You can't do this with everybody. But I think we can have small enough groups and contexts and fellowships where we can have that level of love and accountability. So I'm a very big believer, by the way, in small group dynamics. I have several small groups of men that I meet with for this very reason. And there's something about that you can achieve. And so that the church gathered, when we have a large congregation of people gathering together, is good for worship, but it's not really going to be the main focus for true accountability and nurture and soul care. That requires smaller contexts of one-on-one and small group. He goes on to say, the second flower, give preference to one another in honor. What does he mean by this? You could also translate this, outdo one another in showing honor. Going out of our way to honor other people and to do this with people that we care for. I think one of the things that I need to remind myself in giving preference to another is how I treat Karen in public would be an example of that, you see. And my family, you see. There is an interesting thing, again, that we can take those closest relationships for granted. And often, I've found the temptation of treating your spouse or your children in ways you wouldn't dream of treating as complete strangers. I think there's a strange familiarity that sometimes we take the person for granted rather than honoring them and esteeming them. So there are small kindnesses and small courtesies that would do well to continue to remind ourselves. Is the aesthetics of my relationship declining because I've taken the person for granted, is what I have in mind here. The third of these flowers in these verses is not lagging behind in diligence. It's to be found in verse 11. We're not to be lazy in exercising our spiritual gifts one to another, teaching, helping, showing mercy, leading. There needs to be a willingness to serve others in the use of our spiritual gifts. The fourth of these images or flowers is fervent in spirit. Again, we're still in, we are in verse 11. This is the opposite of a coldly or formal way we sometimes greet one another. There's again a fervency or a warmth toward others. I get to choose how I will regard another person. Again, going back to my own wife, I get to choose how I will look at her. In other words, I can choose to focus on her strengths or on her weaknesses. And you can choose the same with your friends, with members of your family. You can choose how you will look at them. If you wish, you can focus on their shortcomings. Or if you wish, you can choose to focus on what is endearing about them and what their strengths are. And I think that when we choose to focus on those positive things, we discover that our attitude greatly is enhanced as well. And it can actually produce then this mentality of not being cold and distant, but actually having a warmth. It's a choice that we can make. And again, your most powerful resource, apart from the Spirit of God in you, your most powerful resource is your power to make choices. And I believe it's needful for us to train our wills. And your wills, I think, can become weak, and we need to exercise them and train them so that we choose which things we'll think about, which things we will say, what we will do. And you train that like you develop any skill. The one that I think that is most often overlooked is the skill of choosing what we think about. Have you ever thought about that way? Most people simply listen to themselves. They do not choose what they think about. I'll ask you to think about this for a minute. Next time you're at a red light, what's your mind what's your mind go to when you have a little extra time, you're in a line or whatever? If you're like most people, you're probably not so much choosing what you think about. You're probably just reacting to circumstances, grumbling, impatient, or possibly anxious about problems in your life and so forth. My suggestion is that you begin to choose to focus on some kind of truth that you can develop, and that we can take that truth, and then in that context, I'm not talking about being Pollyanna, but I'm saying take the biblical truth and apply it to your circumstances by looking at your life through the lens of truth. Because truth is powerful, and you can either listen to the siren calls of the world and the lies that it propagates, or you can choose what you'll think about, and you can set your mind on the things above rather than the things that are below. That's a choice, and frankly, we need to exercise our will, because I think many people have flaccid wills, flabby, unexercised wills. They don't have power to make choices in how they think, especially, and then what ultimately they do. Again, I'm a big believer in your thought life, and I think that if the thought life is more and more in line with truth, it will ultimately, by nature, spill over into your actual choices, your actions. So he goes on to say, serving the Lord. Again, we are in at the end of verse 11. This is the spirit and attitude of a bondservant. If you look at Luke 17:10 for a second, there's an interesting mindset that it tells us to embrace. He says, so you too, when you do all the things which are commanded you, say, we are unworthy slaves. We have done only that which we ought to have done. Don't be impressed with yourself. That is to say, it is the spirit and the attitude of a bondservant, and this is a root attitude that will bring forth the other flowers. The believer who has a humble spirit before God will excel in honoring other people, because he says, even when I do what I'm called to do, I'm only doing what I should have done. This is my responsibility before God. So that you're focusing on the greatness of God. And then I think that leads to a greater mindset of humility before God, and therefore an openness to serving people. Not taking ourselves too seriously. Remember, again, as I've said many times, I know I've told you this, you don't need to take yourself so seriously because God already does. Therefore, you have nothing to prove. If the living God takes you that seriously, you don't have to impress anybody. Rejoicing in hope is the next image, verse 12. This is to be filled with exultation. It's a biblical hope that leads to the next persevering in tribulation. We will all experience times of tribulation, setbacks, whether financial, physical, emotional, relational. any number of setbacks that can come. And the older we get, the more tribulation we ultimately experience. It's just the way of this world that we, given the fact that we live in a fallen world, will become people of sorrow and acquainted with grief. But we don't have to let the grief define us, because we can walk with hope and to really realize that tribulation actually causes us to lay hold of what we really are hoping in at the end. And it steadfastly endures in the midst of trials because we have an eternal perspective in a temporal world. Devoted to prayer, this idea of persistence in prayer is found in the end of verse 12. This is where you practice his presence. Again, my conviction is that the mistake many followers of Jesus may make is even when they show up in the morning before God, and usually, though, we don't even do that very well. I think we have the crazy idea that you can have one spiritual meal a week and get away with it. Try that with food and see how that would work. I mean, what's obvious in the physical, somehow we miss in the spiritual. But even when they do show up in the morning, they have the idea that that was their time with God. See you tonight before I go to sleep, is the mindset. And you might as well be an atheist the rest of the day for all that God's got involved in your plans and your actions. And I'm suggesting the wisdom of what Brother Lawrence called practicing his presence. And practicing his presence is to take his presence with you and actually invite him to be involved with you in the course of each day and in the course of the hours. And so that we can choose to practice his presence, because my conviction is that God has created us in such a way that our minds are capable of being aware on two levels at once. You are capable, and you know this is true, of being aware of what's going on in the mundane, but also at the same time, there's a possibility of where we can always choose to be aware of God's presence. For example, you can talk to somebody in the flesh or in the spirit. You can teach in the flesh or in the spirit. You can counsel in the flesh or in the spirit. You can serve in the flesh or in the spirit. You can drive in the flesh or in the spirit. We all know the difference. We all know the difference. And so what I'm saying is I can pray for a person and I can still be listening to their conversation, but I can be aware on a different level at the same time. I think that's a skill, again, that you can actually develop by practice, by training. The more you choose to do that, the greater your skill actually will become. So that's why I mean we are actually capable, I believe, of being aware of his presence in the course of even the routines of the day. So that, as I said before, you can peel a spud to the glory of God if you do it with excellence. That whole idea that there is that we if we invite him into the process. Then the next text is in verse number nine, the ninth of these flowers, is contributing to the needs of the saints. And we see here, this image here in James chapter 2, verses 15 and 16, when he talks about people who are in need. In 1 John 3, 17 to 18, those who, if you behold your brother in need. It's not a matter of saying, be warm, be filled, but rather it's the idea, if we have some opportunity to help, my neighbor is the one whose needs are in front of me. Who is my neighbor? And so it's true love then doesn't just speak in word or in tongue, but also in deed and truth, as John tells us. And it participates in the needs of other believers. There are some people in this room with deep needs. Again, some financial, some emotional, some social. And I believe that God will meet their needs as he uses his people to contribute to those, and whatever those may be. So he uses his people for that purpose. The tenth and last of this cluster of flowers is called practicing hospitality, verse 13. This is where we pursue strangers. Hospitality literally means to be a lover of strangers. Hebrews chapter 13, 1 to 3 is that intriguing passage that is somewhat evocative, and really we don't quite know all that he means when he says, let love of the brethren continue, Hebrews 13, 1. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. That's an interesting notion. Is it possible that God once sent somebody and you didn't know that that might have been an angel in disguise? But that's what he says. Remember the prisoners as though in prison with them, and those who are ill-treated, since you yourselves are also in the body. So he says, I want you to identify with the needs of the people that I have placed before you. You cannot meet all the needs in this world. You can't meet the needs in the city. You can't meet the needs in your neighborhood. But there will be specific people that God will give you a burden for, or that he brings into your life. And I believe that if you're sensitive to the prompting of the Spirit of God, you can be a person who becomes a mediator, an agent that God uses in that person's life. And so that's where practicing hospitality. So I want to take this list, verses 1 to 13, rather 9 to 13, and I want to use this as an examination of my own life. Does this list really characterize my own life? Are there any questions on this? Because I could just run into this, just a couple more verses. But if you want any comments or questions. The problem with this, you see, is it's too painfully obvious. That's the problem. Mark Twain says, it's not the parts of the Bible that I don't understand that bother me. It's the parts I do. This isn't hard stuff. It's so painfully obvious that we know exactly what he's saying, you see? And therein lies the rub. How do you do it? Let me just make a comment about this. Let me just look at verses 14 and 16, and then we'll wrap up. What we have here is the third cluster of flowers, and that's specific attitudes that relate to specific problems. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. And this is where the problem of believers who, I think, persecute other believers through false accusations, gossip, slander, caustic and sarcastic criticism. I happened to be in a church last week where there was this problem, and it was very open a problem. They had just dismissed out of hand 11 elders out of 27. It's a big church. And there was a big faction that was caused, and so they were in a very real context of woundedness. And the pastor decided to leave over all this. That was a mess. And I felt very obvious that people were often, that there was a caustic nature and that there were these two factions. And it's not as things were supposed to be. That we were called not to persecute one another, but to in love to serve one another and to see ways in which we can, in fact, find that to become possible, even though we may choose to disagree over specific perspectives. This next verse may be one of the hardest verses in the New Testament to apply. Here's what it is. At first it doesn't sound so, but it is. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Why is that so hard to apply? I will tell you. Because I myself have often found myself rejoicing over those who weep and weeping over those who rejoice. That's why it's hard to apply. I mean by this, when I rejoice over those who weep, when they are having trouble, if I'm not careful, in my flesh, it gives me a way of looking at myself and thinking better of myself, you see, especially if it's a competitor, you see, especially if it's somebody in my industry. Won't bother me much if somebody in a manufacturing business does well, but what if another author does well? You see, or whatever it happens to be. Whatever's closer to you, you'll find what you know what I'm talking about. Suppose we look at the other part. Then he says in verse, where was I? 15, that's it. Weep with those who weep. Suppose I weep with those who rejoice. So I'm unhappy at their success. And I am sorrowful, and I'm happy at their failure. You see how that works. So this is just the opposite. What I'm called to do is to really have another centered mindset, that if God has chosen to bless this person in some way, I must be very, very careful about envy and jealousy and covetousness in my own heart. Because at the point at which I have that, you know what I'm telling God? I'm not satisfied with your level of provision in my life. I'm actually suggesting that God doesn't have my best interests at heart. If he did, he'd give me this, is my mindset. So I tried to define what that looks like rather than having contentment. Contentment and gratitude are two of the most elusive virtues that you'll find on the planet. Only when you are content with the fact that God himself will provide what you need, will you then really and have gratitude of what he's given you, will you be able to move away and follow this kind of verse and really, truly rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not be haughty in mind, but associate with the lowly. Don't be wise in your own estimation. This is a mindset here of humility and radical dependence. To treat people with dignity and respect. And we know again how this works. If I find out that this person's a CEO of a Fortune 500 company, and I find out this person over here happens to be a custodian in a small company in a building, you tell me which one I'm more going to be more inclined to want to curry favor with or try to impress. You see how it works. We're often impressed with the things that don't impress God in a whit. God is not impressed with our accomplishments. He looks at our heart. And frankly, it's often the case that a person here who does not have this world's goods may be actually rich in faith, more rich perhaps than one who has esteem and power. Not to say it's always that way, but it's to say this, that the issue is the heart issue, and stop being impressed by the things that impress the world and be impressed by the things that are pleasing to God. When we do that, I think we move in the right direction. I fear that I'm out of time. Let me close in a prayer. Lord, we thank you for this opportunity to reflect together on these timeless truths. I pray that we would be people who are not merely hearers of the word and then deceive ourselves, but I pray that you would actually cause us to be doers of the word. I pray that we would walk in our new identity in Jesus, to walk in the power of your spirit, knowing that we cannot live this kind of life on our own, but you can do it through us and in us, as we invite you to love other people through us, and we invite you to serve people through us. We invite you to forgive people through us. We invite you to have compassion on people, in people's lives through us. Cause us to be more and more dependent as we see that we cannot live this life. We see that Jesus can do it through us. We pray in his name. Amen.